Welcome to all Red Ice members. Thank you so much for joining us here for this second segment with our guest Kevin P. Miller, and we are talking about his film Generation RX and the drugging of children. And I'd like to begin to talk about some of the detrimental effects on a society as a whole because of these different psychotropic drugs. Prozac, Ritalin, Luvox, Paxil, and all the others have actually a direct link to many school shootings, not only in the U.S., but around the world. Not too long ago, this happened in Finland, another one in Germany earlier this year. Let's talk about some of the examples that you bring up in your film, Kevin, like Columbine. We have Virginia Tech. There's another one at the mall, I think it was called the Omaha Mall or something like that. What is happening here? Are really SSRIs and psychotropic drugs to blame for these events?
Well, I mean, let's put it this way, Henrik. You can draw a definitive line to the fact that 9 out of the 13 or so school shooters have been on these SSRI antidepressant medications, sometimes in addition to another drug like a speed drug, Ritalin, methylphenidate, what have you, Luvox, et cetera. But oftentimes it's just the SSRI medication alone. And this is mirrored by the data that's coming in from all different corners of the earth. As you mentioned, Germany and Finland, two of the more recent, but there's also been cases in England and elsewhere. And the only people, as a matter of fact, that I'm aware of that have taken some definitive action on this, or again, the people of Holland, who have banned the advertising of all the ADHD drugs and many of the psychiatric medications in general. And, you know, what we show in the film is that it's not only these violent acts in school shootings, et cetera, but little, I call them little girls, I'm sorry, but I mean 11-year-old girls, 10-year-old girls who are being prescribed these medications are hanging themselves, committing suicide. And when I think about little girls who are 10 or 11 years old and not even in the prime of their lives, obviously, at that point or anywhere near, going to the garage of their parents' home and taking the methodical time to literally find a rope and or a cord and stringing it up a certain way, listening to the voices in their head, and then literally hanging themselves to the point of death is, it just takes your breath away.
It does.
There is a definite correlation, to be sure.
It's just insane. How does it go, do you think, from being an application for a psychological disorder and then all of a sudden turning violent? How come these kids become so violent? Do you have an answer to that?
I think because we're rewiring their brains. And there's no, there is no guarantee that one person's brain will react in the same way that someone else will. And oftentimes, with these kids, quote unquote kids, they are, younger. They're under 20 years old, or in some cases as young, as I said, as 10 years old. And the brains are still developing. So there's just no way to predict which ones are going to have a violent or suicidal reaction to these drugs. But there's no doubt that the intent of the drug is to rewire the brain.
So you mentioned suicides as well, but then there's also random murders. I remember actually a guy here in Sweden back in 2003 who actually stabbed our Minister of Foreign Affairs to death. He was also getting treatment for psychological problems, and he was also on a some kind of drug. I don't remember if it was a psychotropic or SSRI or whatever it was, but yet another case. So kids are even going after their parents in some cases.
Well, you hear a lot of this in the film Generation RX, don't you, Henrik?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
We go through this litany, if you will, of people who stand up. And in one case, I'll remember that one woman in the 1991 testimony before the Food and Drug Administration about Prozac stood up and talked about her father taking the drug and then stabbing himself repeatedly in the abdomen a number of times before he died. And I mean, to be able to withstand the physical pain alone. I mean, we talked about the muting of emotions and the deadening of emotions. I mean, in order to be in that place where one could repeatedly stab themselves in the abdomen with a sharp butcher knife, and to be able to withstand that pain and continue to do it a second and third and fourth time is almost incomprehensible, isn't it?
It is. Do you think it's a cry for help, or is there something else going on here? I mean, again, many kids have reported that they hear, you know, voices, they're given instructions and orders. What do you think is happening here?
I think that the very drug that's being given to them to cure them is causing mental illness. It's causing this chemical imbalance. It's causing this severe reaction within the brain where things just don't add up anymore and things are upside down. I think their entire world is upside down. Again, I mean, for a woman, for a girl, like one of the girls I feature in the film, to have hung herself, to hang herself in the garage. I mean, I during the course of the film, Henrik, I received and scanned probably 400 photographs of this beautiful young girl. Her name is Candace Downing. And every single one of the 400 photographs, she was smiling. I mean, smiling like a super happy smile. Mm. So it's obvious that this was not a girl that was severely bothered by depression. She was prescribed Zoloft in this case, because she had an anxiety about taking exams at school. And so the psychiatrist said, well, we'll just put her on a small dose. Well, a few weeks later, this is what happened. So, you know, again, I mean, that's the thing when you delve into one's life and you get to know the parents and the sister and the family members like I did during the course of filming Generation RX, and you get to see what a beautiful family they are and how lovingly attentive they are to each other and how they were to Candace. And yet somehow Candace came to this very dark, dead place. And indeed, her brain chemistry was telling her to do something that I dare say that she would have never done under normal circumstances.
Do you know if the parents at this time were noticing the change in these few weeks? Because again, it's just incredible how quickly it seems to affect some of the kids that are taking these medications.
Well, they did. As a matter of fact, they noticed a couple of times that she said that she wasn't doing well, and she was, again, sort of talking gibberish, if you will, at one point. And so they took her to the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said, no, everything you're doing is great, and she's doing wonderfully, and I think she's going to be great. And literally less than 24 hours later, she had hanged herself in the garage.
Do you think that ultimately, though, the parents are responsible here, even for, you know, to hand everything over, so to speak, to the psychiatrist in this case?
No, I really don't. The Downings, as I said, were very caring people and caring parents. And indeed, if anything, that they kick themselves for now and what keeps them awake at night now is that they knew that they had questioned their doctor, and they were against putting Candace on this medication. But the doctor reassured them that it was a very small dose and that nothing would happen, and that, you know. So, you know, if anything, the only thing they're guilty of is listening to their doctor.
Yeah.
And what they've done is turned into terrific activists on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, where they are raising these kinds of concerns. And I should mention, by the way, that this is a really critical aspect, because I've been following the Food and Drug Administration for over 25 years now and researching and investigating them. And there's a central figure at the tenet of the film and from the Food and Drug Administration named Dr. Thomas Loughran, L-A-U-G-H-R-E-N is the spelling. And Thomas Loughran is the head of the psychopharmacology division at the Food and Drug Administration. And oddly, ironically enough, he was friends of the Downings. And Dr. Thomas Loughran of the FDA, his daughters, actually slept at the Downings' home. And the Downing children slept at his home in overnight stays. And so I think the thing that struck me most was the complete, uncaring, cold reaction of Dr. Loughran, who refused to address the Downings after this had happened, refused to warn the Downings when he knew that Candace was on an antidepressant drug. And later, the Downings found out through their own due diligence, and again, I unveil the actual documents and show them in Generation RX, that show that he's indeed the person who approved the use of SSRI antidepressant drugs for children and among children, even though there had never been studies done to prove the safety and efficacy of those drugs for children.
That is just insane. Do you think that he's getting money from the pharmaceutical companies? What is up with this guy here?
Well, there's two things. I mean, number one, he's been with them. He was also present at the 1991 Prozac hearing, so he could never make the claim that he didn't know that these drugs were potentially harmful. The people that I show in the film from the 1991 video testimony clearly were telling him by the dozens how dangerous this drug could be. So he knew going back to the mid-80s when I highlight another letter, fax, that he had sent to someone from Eli Lilly, saying that the firm had a friend in Dr. Bob Temple of the Food and Drug Administration and that he would take good care of Eli Lilly's needs. And so, you know, the bottom line is, number one, he already has a very attractive government pension, I'm sure, being in working for the government for the last 25 or 30 years. But the state of the nation as it is at the Food and Drug Administration is that there's simply a revolving door, Henrik.
Yeah.
The people who are forced out of FDA or who leave voluntarily FDA immediately become invaluable, priceless players for the pharmaceutical industry or for big food or for anybody else that has to do business before the Food and Drug Administration. And so he has a golden parachute whether or not he is wealthy now or not. He has indeed an open door to join any pharmaceutical company he wants to in the world and to become an instant multimillionaire as a result of his knowledge and position of authority. So there are people like that. I mean, I write about in my blog, if people ever search for information on Michael R. Taylor, who's the former deputy commissioner of policy at FDA, I write about him extensively. He appears in Generation RX, an interview that I conducted with him in 1994 or late 93. And he appears prominently because the bovine growth hormone that's in most milk in, again, Western nations, recombinant bovine growth hormone, a synthetic hormone created by Monsanto. Well, that was approved by the FDA on Michael R. Taylor's watch when he was second in command at FDA in the 1990s. And then when my film, Let Truth Be the Bias, exposed Michael Taylor and had the first and only interview ever with Michael Taylor on camera, he was forced out of FDA. So where did he go? He went from Food and Drug Administration to the Department of Agriculture. And what did he do? His first action at Department of Agriculture was approving the RBGH growth hormone that's now in cows and in our cow's milk that's being consumed by tens of millions of children around the world. So, you know, when he left Department of Agriculture, where did he go? Well, he went back to Monsanto's legal team, which is where he began. So this kind of unethical revolving door continues, and it's a double standard. It's a double set of rules for those powerful people on the inside and for big business. And it's something that, truthfully, in this age of multinational corporate interests trumping democracy, I mean, we've made capitalism more important than democratic rights. It's something we really need to examine and something, in my opinion, that we really need to stop and stop now.
Yeah. Similar examples here in the UK. One Professor Sir Roy Anderson, government swine flu advisor, is actually getting a payroll a pay from GlaxoSmithKline as well over in the UK. So there's similar stories everywhere, and these are it's just incredible that this is allowed to continue. And although it's in some of the mainstream papers, we don't hear too much about it. It's just incredible to me. What's your take on all this? How can they get away with it legally, so to speak?
Well, I think in part the media, at least I'll speak to the United States, but I think it's applicable worldwide. The media here have become corporate media. And so a film like mine, which really unveils very, very critically important aspects of this corruption and collusion and the shoddy science that we've discussed before and all of these things, which I challenge every day, every single journalist. If you find something that's not factual in my film, challenge me on it. And yet, heretofore, no one has ever challenged my facts, nor has anyone ever gone on the evening news that's broadcast to 20 million people and told people about not only my film, but more importantly, the facts that are in the film. And so what's happened is that the corporate media has developed this inside the beltway or inside the Washington, D.C. mindset. And so many of them are so afraid that if they cross the line and if they challenge the Food and Drug Administration or a National Institutes of Health official or National Cancer Institute official or someone else, if they challenge them and expose them, that their contacts will dry up within the governmental community. And therefore, they'll never get a scoop anymore. They won't get a lead. They won't beat the competition to the story. So unfortunately, that seems to be what is most pervasive. And I'll give the BBC credit, because the BBC, while it does have serious problems, has done a far better job of exposing the truth behind these psychiatric medications, the side effects, the suicides, the deaths, than American media has by far.
Hmm. Well, I guess the reason why they don't touch your material, so to speak, is that you would come out the other end proving them wrong, I think. And have you tried to contact mainstream media, press releases and so forth, to try to get the word out about this?
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, one of the first letters and first copies of the film that I sent out in November of last year was to a gentleman from the New York Times, who his name is Gardner Harris, and he has written about Senator Charles Grassley's investigations on the Senate level in the United States about academics who are on the take of the pharmaceutical companies, and so when they're not reporting income and things of this nature. But I sent him a copy of the film, and I even had some conversations and emails back and forth. And he's even spoken with Matthew Milling Downing, Candace Downing's mom, the little girl who committed suicide, and promised her that he was going to do a story, and promised her repeatedly that he was going to do a story. And here it is 4, 5, 6 months later, and he refuses to do it. He even went so far as to tell me that he had, quote, heard the same thing that I've reported in Generation RX about Thomas Loughran, about him covering the behinds of Eli Lilly, and about these Prozac and dark stories having to do with SSRI medications. He claims to me that he's heard those before. Well, clearly, my film goes beyond just telling you about it. It proves, it shows the documents dating to 1986, I believe, is the first one that I feature of Thomas Loughran. And then 1990, 1991, 1992, 1994, all of these documents where Thomas Loughran is in the middle of this. And yet Gardner Harris of the New York Times, perhaps the most respected print publication in America, refuses to tell the truth. Hmm. So I can't speak to what the motivation or fear is behind not telling the truth to the American people.
Yeah. Do you think they're stopped on the editorial level, so to speak, of the magazine, that you might have an independent journalist or even freelance or a reporter that is reporting and talking about the issue, but it's just the fact is that it doesn't end up in the final print, so to speak, because it stopped by the editor.
It's very possible. I know that, Henrik, you and I are both in a new book called The Dangerous Man that's coming out, written by Kieran Sawyer, a wonderfully talented author in the United Kingdom. And my segment in there talks about the corporatization of media. And it talks about how, you know, when you've created a system, particularly in America, that where the evening news, the nightly evening newscast on the three major broadcast networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, when all of those newscasts that come on at 6:30 at night, Eastern time in the U.S., every single one of them are paid for by pharmaceutical advertising. And it's so odd. It's an oddest sensation. If you're here in America and you're turning on television at that time to watch the evening news, when they go to a commercial, you see a drug ad. If you change the channel, most of the other channels are also on commercials, and those will also be drug ads. So we're talking about billions of dollars here. We are literally talking about billions of dollars just to support the evening newscasts, Henrik.
Yeah.
So there's little doubt that there's a wink and a nod. And, you know, I mean, even the giant CBS News program called 60 Minutes admitted that they caved into pressure about big tobacco, about research, honest to God research about big tobacco, and that they killed their own story back in the, I believe it was in the 1990s or 80s, mm-hmm. and that they killed their own story because of the potential ramifications of reporting it. Not only in loss of dollars, but in lawsuits and other things.
Yes, and losing out on the funding if you have those corporations, you know, as you say, in between the breaks of the newscast, you have those corporations sponsoring the whole thing. So that would be to, in one way, you know, strike at the hand that feeds you in a way, and they wouldn't want to do that. And I guess the problem here in one way then is that it's primarily a business. Many of these channels and so forth are, they're run as a business, and that's the main thing. And I think that, do you think that our attitude towards them have to change, that they really provide not as a service, that they're just like any other TV program, basically, but we sit there and believe that it's the this is the truth that we're getting, and this is you know, fair and square, so to speak, and it's our fault in a way there, because we're naive and think that they have an obligation to us, but they really don't, because it's just as another product, isn't there, in one way?
Yes, in one way, that's very true. I mean, I was raised as a journalist and studied as a journalist and was a high school journalist, and I still have a lot of admiration for journalism and for individual journalists. There are definitely journalists out there, particularly in the newspaper side, who are doing fine investigative work and revealing patterns of corruption and things every single day in this country and around the world. But the problem is more pervasive, Henrik. It's even pervasive in the taxpayer supported TV, like here in America, it's PBS, and of course in the UK it's the BBC, because who is supporting that? It's not only taxpayers that are supporting those radio and TV networks, but naturally it's corporations.
Yeah,
and so we've allowed the you know, the very controversial things, the things like in Generation RX. I like to think that yes, it's controversial. I had a PBS interviewer ask me one time if I thought that my material was fringe.
Really?
And I said, well, I suppose it is fringe compared to what is being reported on a daily basis. But if you consider the fact that reporting that the Drug Enforcement Administration says that there's a 734% increase in the use of speed and Ritalin methylphenidate among our children in a 3.5-year period, if that's fringe, that's where I want to be.
Exactly.
So you know, I mean, it's a very difficult question. And moreover, where we should really be kicking ourselves, Henrik, in my opinion, is that now that we're in this digital age, and I'm not so certain that this doesn't have a hand, some corporate influences in at work here also. For example, I create Generation RX. Obviously, a very thoughtful film, feature-length film. I came to Europe to film. I spent, we lay completely low to the earth. We weren't living at the Ritz or in a posh hotel. We had a crew of three, sometimes four. And, you know, but it cost us for the 2 weeks that we were gone, it cost $30,000 to $35,000 between flights, hotels, travel, you know, meals, lights, you know, various equipment we had to rent.
Yep.
Well, now what people do is they'll go to Generation RX and they'll look online.
Yep.
And there's people who have illegally uploaded Generation RX into what are called BitTorrent files that you're very familiar with. And people will just illegally download them and without a thought. And so we should be kicking ourselves as a society, because what's going to happen is, how do the Kevin Millers of the world continue to make films? I'm not Michael Moore. I don't have a $10 million budget. I'm not the big news media. I'm not NBC, CBS, ABC. And yet I'm obviously reporting extremely important things in a very sophisticated way, hopefully in a very artistic and journalistic way. And so what we're doing is we're putting people like me out of business because we can't even afford to pay back to sell enough DVDs or to get the licensing for television where it's going to support even just covering the costs of a film like this. And so people need to challenge themselves and the immorality of stealing someone else's work when that work is not just solely designed for profit, but it's designed to empower people with the information they need in order to make very important choices about healthcare, about government, about codecs and free trade, about all of these issues that I care so deeply about that no one else is reporting on.
Yeah. I totally agree. It is a very, very big problem. And in one way, I think someone said as well there, it's that balance between also how to get, obviously, the information out to as many people as possible, and also that idea that if you find something online and if you really like it and want to encourage the maker of the film, then go and support the filmmaker or whatever it is that you're seeing and get a copy of it. That also is one way about it. But I definitely understand your problem here, so to speak. And that's something that you know, even Hollywood these days are facing. Okay, they're still making loads and loads of money, obviously, but in one way, what it might end up in is that it's going to be just worse and worse and worse productions in one way, right? It's just, it's not going to hold up the journalistic value anymore, because people won't have the money to make the films and to do the research and to spend the time that it takes in the meantime while they're doing the film. To put that into research.
That's very true.
Yeah.
That's very true. Or it could be the other way too, Henrik, and that is that the only thing left at the end of the day will be, you know, people will be downloading these BitTorrent files and they'll be ripping off Hollywood movies. And then, of course, the only other option will be people speaking directly into a webcam or something with no production value whatsoever. And yet what's odd is that, you know, when you have a film like mine that's done for very, very, very modest six figures, you know, again, to spend $10 million on a Michael Moore film and then an extra $20 million on marketing that film, you've got 30 to 35 to $40 million tied up in one film. And here for, you know, if you look at it, this film, I think, actually competes in terms of the level of professionalism, the quality of the production itself. I think it actually competes with a Michael Moore, if not is even better, dare I say.
It does.
You know, so if you have that level of production and it costs, let's just pick a figure, $200,000 or something to produce that, versus, you know, you could produce five of those films for $1 million. As opposed to one $10 million film from Michael Moore.
Yeah.
So what I'm hoping happens is that there's a shift of some sort that will begin to acknowledge independent filmmakers like myself and people who are devoted, you know, to doing this kind of research, as you noted. I mean, you know, I've been doing this research for 25 years, and during Generation RX, Henrik, I spent 18 hours a day working on this for about 14, 15 months. So, you know, I'm hoping that we can find some happy medium and that people will actually respond and actually do the right thing and support the work that I think is really important for all of us to see.
Absolutely, and I hope that folks do support you and your research, the films that you're making and so forth. And while we're on the subject of money here, Kevin, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the reasons for why possibly the pharmaceutical oil cartel, as you mentioned in the first hour, what the reasons are for them to do all this, so to speak. Do you think the primary cause here is money? You mentioned there's trillions of dollars in the making here, at least if we incorporate into this the whole swine flu vaccination issue and so forth as well. Do you think that money is the primary reason, or is there an alternative motive here, so to speak?
That's a great question. There's a piece in my blog. Again, if anybody just searches Kevin P. Miller, and then there's a blog called that I wrote called A Letter of Thanks to the Drug Companies. And in that letter, it's a tongue-in-cheek letter. I note that on the very first day that the DVD was available online, that 12 drug companies and or their public relations firms bought the DVD on the very first day that the film was available.
How about that?
So I think that, you know, they wanted to naturally find out what was in there, look, see where the bodies were found, were buried, and what they needed to do to answer this. Should this ever come up? Should the mainstream media ever be bold enough to report it to 10 or 20 million people? So that was part of the reason. But this goes back so far. I mean, this is really a monopoly, and with monopoly comes money, of course. But the real essence of it is power, I believe, and the whole nature of what we're seeing through Codex Alimentarius is that the multinational corporate interests want to funnel our health care, our collective health care, Europe, United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, you name it, through them. They want to set standards. They want to tell us that we're only able to take vitamin C in 250 milligram capsules, maybe, or that we can't take glucosamine sulfate for a bad knee, or that the synthetic version of vitamin D is available, but the organic version or the natural version of vitamin D is not available. Same thing with vitamin E. What they're trying to do is to seize power, and they're trying to keep it from us so that we are not able to use basically therapeutic doses of vitamins, herbs, amino acids, and the like, to treat ourselves, to be well. And I think that is probably at the core of all this.
Absolutely. And again, a consequence of that would be that we become eventually, in one way, dependent even more on the pharmaceutical companies, because we'll go to them for remedies instead of vitamins and natural supplements and so forth. And I think that is the plan as well, to totally control the whole, not only in terms of diet, but also in terms of supplements, and eventually down the road, even have the whole freaking population on some kind of medication. That's where I think they, in their wet dream, so to speak, that's what they want. You know what I mean?
Oh, I definitely agree with that. And you know, I might just mention that you talk about specifics. About 3 years ago, the European distributor of a Canadian company was effectively put out of business for selling an entirely safe dietary supplement that had not been approved by Belgium's health department. And the gentleman's home, the home of his daughter, the home of his son, they were raided. The products were seized. He was fined 1.3 million euros, all for not conforming to a regulation for a safe product. The product was targeted, of course, because it was cutting into the prescription drug market. And it's the same kind of control that is happening in Canada right now. I'm off to Canada in about 10 days to begin filming a short film to tackle some health freedom issues up there. So I'd ask, you know, there's a bill called C6, Bill C6 in Canada, that is a very serious bill that, In the language of the bill, Henrik, if you can believe this, it actually had language in there that stated that Canada had to honor its free trade agreements. And what that meant was that the World Trade Organization, for example, should they rule on something that be because Canada is part of the World Trade Organization, that they would have to abide by it.
Yep.
And what that really means in the, when the, is that the World Trade Organization could institute a ruling, a law, if you will, and it could circumvent Canadian Parliament. I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
When we've got, you know, behind closed doors, it's not even a democracy, as I say in We Become Silent, my film about Codex. It's this bureaucratic, secretive entity that meets behind closed doors and rules on issues and supplements and other health matters behind closed doors. For them, this 14-person panel or something, to create a judgment and then have it circumvent the elected officials of Canada and go directly into Canadian law? I mean, does it get any more Orwellian than this?
It doesn't.
And yet this is what we're facing in Canada, my Canadian friends and brethren. And increasingly, this is what you're facing in Europe.
Yep.
It's not only Belgium, of course. It's throughout the nations of Europe.
Absolutely. And as long as we don't say any, I mean, they're not going to end up in a situation where they ask us, can we do this, please? They just, you know, go ahead and do it. And they don't ask anybody. And if we don't say anything about it, obviously nothing is going to change, right?
No, that's exactly it. And I know that in my film, We Become Silent, I interviewed Congressman Ron Paul, who, as you know, ran for president in last year. And he's got quite an underground following, if you will. And it, one of the things that Ron Paul has been a proponent of that actually comes up in 2010, I believe in the fall of 2010, is that every 5 years Congress of the United States has to approve membership in the World Trade Organization.
Hmm.
So theoretically, we could bow out of the WTO next year as a nation. And obviously, I'm full of prayer that that's what happens, even though I don't think it's likely.
Yeah.
I think that it is going to get a lot more votes than it's ever gotten. For example, in 2005, in 2000, when it first came up, I think there were, I don't know, I think it was 27 votes. And there's 427 people, I believe, in Congress. In 2005, it came up again. And when it came up for vote, I believe it was, it's near 200, 180 some odd. So again, you know, we might find ourselves at the tipping point if from everything from workers being out of work to these very cloistered, secretive, bureaucratic entities making decisions and stripping us of our freedoms. You know, in a perfect world, that would happen in 2010.
Well, that's a very good idea and something to keep an eye on upcoming then in that sense. But, you know, in regards to what you just described here about the WTO, this seems to be across the board. And I just don't understand how governments around the world and the national governments can sign up to these organizations where, again, we have these few men, in some cases, a few women in there as well, advisory boards and so forth that basically are making judgments for millions, ultimately billions of people on this planet without asking anybody. Until we say something about it, nothing is going to change on that end.
Well, I very much, one of the films that I've targeted that I'm out raising money for right now, Henrik, is a film about a documentary about free trade. And I'm very hopeful that I'll be able to produce that and possibly get it produced somehow before a year from now, so that this could become part of the conversation as we debate whether or not to continue with the World Trade Organization. But you're right. I think that the initial thing that attracts people to trade is that there's this perception that what's good for American corporations or European corporations is good for the people of that nation. And, you know, maybe in the old days, that was a little more true. But the fact of the matter is now in Detroit, when the automakers are laying off tens and hundreds of thousands of workers, and then you find out that the engine blocks are being made in Mexico or in South America or somewhere else, or just simple phone calls that could be paying someone $10 an hour to answer a phone for a corporation and being shipped to India because they're getting that same worker for $3 an hour.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the point where we've reached where it's become a moral question, in my opinion. And our shareholders are a finite amount of shareholders, no matter how large the corporation, are the finite amount of shareholders suddenly more important than the American people themselves?
Yeah.
Or you know, the Swedish people themselves, or the Dutch, or you name it, right?
Yeah. So do you think, Kevin, that these organizations like the WTO and so forth are a stepping stone to a bigger organization? This is a bigger plan here towards a world government. Do you think that that's the case here?
Well, I think with some of the consolidation that's gone on with the scares from the last year over the banking, I think that we have set ourselves up to now banking will become even more centralized, fewer choices, fewer small banks, fewer, quote, savings and loan organizations that are truly just committed to their body of customers. And we're creating these huge reserves that are going to be in the hands of the most powerful people in the world. I don't think there's any question about that.
Yeah.
I mean, JP Morgan Chase here in the United States, and, you know, I mean, they're just go down the list, right? AIG, the insurance company / banking institution / broker / you know, I mean, these people have now crossed over into every imaginable entity that touches and influences our lives.
Absolutely.
And so I do think that that without some real change, that we are indeed seeing the steps being taken as we're speaking now towards creating a centralized, if not a centralized government, most certainly a centralized banking system and other centralized means of control.
Yeah, absolutely. There's the IMF already, of course, but then there's also the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, based out of Basel in Switzerland. Definitely one big organization that people need to keep an eye on. And I think that this issue that you mentioned here about the banking systems and so forth is yet again will be pushed at the upcoming G20 meeting in Pittsburgh. And there's hints already that this is what it's leading towards. And again, this is another way that they cleverly do it in one way. They manifest a disturbing situation, so to speak, upheaval, some kind of crash or something like that. And the outcome, the solution to that will always lead towards a more centralized decision making. And that's how we're being fooled from my point of view.
And I agree with you. And I wish that, I mean, I'd love to get credentials to be able to be in the G20. But as you see, when these WTO meetings are held worldwide or these G20 meetings are held, the people who are there in protest are called anarchists.
Yeah.
And, you know, since when did expressing oneself in a peaceful manner become anarchy? And yet this bothers these people's notion of control. And this corporate ideology that it is indeed capitalism before everything. And to me, that almost harkens back to the days of Khrushchev mocking the United States and the West in general about capitalism. Hmm. Because somehow it has morphed into this thing that's, if not exactly what Khrushchev described, is dangerously close to becoming that.
Hmm. You know, it's like nationalists are seen as extremists now, and as you say, in some cases anarchists and so forth as well. And some of them are also. Some of them are agent provocateurs who they're in there to start the riots and so forth. This is something that shattered the city that we're close to right now, Gothenburg in Sweden, back in 2001, where they held a a big meeting here. Bush was visiting. This was just the summer here before 9/11 and so forth, and a lot of EU people were up here. And same thing happened here that happened in Seattle previously and so forth. The whole town was shattered pretty much by these people who probably are even on some kind of government payroll or something to set, upset the situation and to disturb peaceful protesters from showing themselves pretty much. So it's a big problem, you know?
It really is. And you heard Tony Blair talking about this when there was a WTO meeting in the UK when Tony Blair was still around. And he was actually a week prior out there saying, we will not allow these anarchists. So he was already framing the conversation through the news, the cooperative news media, of course. He was already framing the conversation that anyone who protests is an anarchist. And so this is the problem. And I think part of the solution is with Red Ice and the great work that you're doing. I think that ultimately I'm trying to get out there and fund a weekly news health show, for example, a 30-minute program every week that will be on the internet and TV, et cetera, called Health Center. And it will be honest-to-God journalism. And I think part of the solution is that we need to create powerful media across, especially where it's possible to do English-speaking media together without the barrier, potential barrier of languages. And we need to join together so that there's a distribution model that allows us, all of us that are doing our important work in our respective countries and cities, to distribute one another's work and to make it possible for us to support one another's work, or for the people of America to support Red Ice Creations even more than they already do so, and the people of Europe throughout Europe to support, you know, not only my films, but the TV work that I want to do and that I believe is vital. And we can create a new paradigm for ourselves. We can create this new shift, but we have to act on it. Everything else is just nonsense. So we need to act, and we need to support one another, and we need to band together in this international way so that even if big media or big government or big corporations try to block us, we've already developed our own audience, pure to Red Ice Creations and pure to Kevin P. Miller and pure to, you know, all of the other entities, and whether it's David Icke, you know, the other people who are doing a work that is seen as controversial.
Yeah.
And I believe that if we created such a network, Henrik, then we would successfully be able to see real change in areas that we've never seen before.
Absolutely. It's a great idea, and I think that that's the way to do it as well. And it's a collaboration across the borders, of course. And just as you say, we need support from people. It's just as simple as that. And, you know, Kevin, to begin then, to round things up for this time, please mention your websites again so people who are out there and want to support you and want to get your films know where to go to check out some of your the material that you have out there for us, Kevin.
Anyone that wants to see the film, they can buy the film, could go to either Amazon.com in the U.S. or worldwide, or to GenerationRxFilm.com. That's GenerationRxFilm.com. And I'd love them to check out my blogs as well. They can simply search Kevin P. Miller in Google and put down Kevin P. Miller blog, and they'll find the address. I have one blog at kevinmiller.com, but I also have another blog that has all kinds of video and other things attached to it, other kinds of media attached to it. So I appreciate you spreading the word.
We will have these links up on redicecreations.com, of course. Again, thank you so much for joining us, Kevin, and keep up the great work, okay?
I look forward to meeting you in February, if not sooner, Henrik. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, that's our program with Kevin P. Miller. Thank you for joining us here in the members area. We have some good shows coming your way soon with Nick Rosen on how to live outside the Big Brother grid. We also have Cliff Pye from halfpasthuman.com joining us to talk about the WebWatch project and future viewing. My thanks to Frederick and Elizabeth for their hard work. We will be back soon. Take good care. Bye for now.